Okay, I think we need to get started again. Now, we were just about to begin a discussion of point four, the belief in inherent group conflicts over allegedly fixed employment opportunities. Recall that consumptionism implies that there's a fixed stock of work to be done in the world, namely that amount of work required to produce the allegedly fixed limited output that people are prepared to buy. So that's all the work there. Machinery is allegedly reducing the overall total. But put machinery aside now, and let's assume that something happens that increases the total labor force, and that would require full employment to employ more people. Well, let's look at that in terms of the diagrams we've been looking at. Here we are. This is the production function. We're not worrying about machinery right now. Full employment is at F. Output is A. The market is taking that output. But what will happen if the labor force increases? Instead of full employment being met when we employ F of labor, suppose full employment would now require that we employ H of labor, because there are more workers. And there could be more workers from a variety of different sources. Let's imagine that up to now we have an economy where the only people working are men, and for the sake of ease of illustration, we'll assume they're all married. And now all of their wives want to go to work too. All right, what would that imply about the total size of the labor force?
Double.
It would double. And so full employment would mean you'd have to employ not only all the men you previously employed, but also all of the women who joined the labor force. And this would be represented by the higher amount, H. Now, even if the production function is the same, even if we have the same relationship between a unit of labor and a unit of output, if instead of F of labor producing the output A, we have H of labor producing the output, how much will it produce? How much will H of labor produce on this production function? What's the letter that denotes it?
B.
B, just like machinery. So these women going to work, that's as bad as machinery. So here we are. If we had full employment, we'd have the output B. But if the market only is willing to take this given fixed output A, are we very long going to be able to produce the larger output B?
No.
So what will happen to production? It'll be cut back to A where it was, and there'll only be the same number of people working. We'll end up with the same number of people working as we had before. We'll just have F of labor. But notice the implication of this is that to whatever extent people in this new additional group, in this illustration the women, to whatever extent they land jobs and they're now counted as part of F, what is supposedly the effect on the employment of men? That they have lost jobs. Well, don't you every so often see an angry letter to the editor, or maybe hear something in a bar room? These married women are taking the jobs of male breadwinners. Well, what analysis does that rest on? What are the underlying assumptions? That there's a fixed stock of work to be done, and to whatever extent women claim some of that stock, there's equivalently less for men to do. Now, it doesn't just have to be women. It can be any group. The additional supply of labor could be the Mexican immigrants crossing the border, or any immigrants. And very often you'll hear it argued, we can't allow these immigrants because they're taking jobs from the native-born. Well, what's the assumption about the number of jobs? That it's a fixed given total, that it can't be expanded. Now, the same points apply in many different places, in different contexts. I'm sure there's application to Northern Ireland. You have bitter conflict in Northern Ireland between Catholics and Protestants. And the way they view things is, To whatever extent a Protestant gets a job, there's that many less jobs for Catholics, and vice versa. Up in Quebec, I think they have a problem. They view it as, to whatever extent English speakers get a job, there's that fewer jobs for French speakers, and vice versa. In Bosnia, they have the same issue. To whatever extent Serbs get jobs, there's that many fewer for Bosnians, and vice versa. So this is a very widespread phenomenon. And let me elaborate on it. There is no need for such conflict. There is room out there for the employment of everybody. There's room for all of the men to be working and the married women to work as well, side by side. The quantity of labor employed can be expanded to include them all, plus the immigrants, plus the Catholics, the Protestants, the Serbs, and the Bosnians, whatever. There is no fixed limit to the number of workers who can be employed. What's necessary for the market to absorb more workers?
More spending.
Well, suppose we have just such and so much spending, would there be no way that we could employ more workers without having to be concerned about boosting spending? Yes? If wage rates were free to fall, as wage rates fall, what happens to the quantity of labor demanded? It goes up. And in a free labor market, a labor market in which there were no minimum wage laws, no labor union interference, wage rates would go to the point of making possible a quantity of labor demanded equal to the supply available. Now, an immediate question that should be on everyone's minds is, yeah, well, maybe that's true, but doesn't this mean that wage rates would go way down? People would be working for starvation wages. Let me point out that that would be a very incomplete, erroneous economic analysis. Many, many people make the mistake, as soon as they see an implication of wage rates having to fall, they immediately assume that this is against the interests of the wage earners and implies a corresponding fall in their standard of living. Let's take the case of married women going to work, and let's make some extreme assumptions. Let's assume that total payroll funds in the economic system were rigidly fixed. There's however many trillions of payrolls that can be financed, and that's it. Up to now, only males have been working, and there's a certain number of them. But now, over some period of time, they're going to be joined by their wives. We've assumed that all the workers are married. So we'll end up with a neat doubling of the supply of labor. It's nice to work with doubling because everyone presumably can divide by two. So what would have to happen to the average level of money wage rates so that the same total payrolls could employ twice the number of workers? Okay, they would be cut in half. Now, if we have twice the workers working, what should we infer will happen to production, at least if these workers are if the additional workers are as efficient as the previous workers, and that's implied in wage rates halving, but they're counting as the full equivalent of labor. So what can we infer should be happening to the total output?
Production should double.
Okay, production should double. We should have twice the workers at half the wages, and that should result in twice the output. And if we have the same total spending to buy output, the total spending to buy the output will be larger than the payrolls, but by some amount, but both are unchanged. Like total payrolls might be $4 trillion. Total spending to buy consumers' goods might be $5 trillion. They'd both be fixed at those numbers. Well, if we have twice the output that has to be sold for the same sum of money, what's implied about prices? How much? They should fall in half too. All right, now, if here's our situation, we have twice the labor employed at half the average wage per worker, and twice the labor is producing twice the output, which is being sold at half the average unit price. What is the situation of the average working family that has two members each earning half the previous wage of the one? Their family income is unchanged. the same money income that the male breadwinner used to earn, the man and his wife together are now earning in the average case, but what are the prices that they're paying? Half as much. So what is implied about their real family income? It has doubled. They have the same money, and they're buying at half the prices, which means they can buy twice as much. Now, isn't this an incredible shock? Two people are working, and they have double the real income. See, it may happen that...
where does that happen?
Pardon me? Where does that happen?
Yeah.
It's happened right here, everywhere, where you have more people employed. And see, just think, what is the effect on families with two breadwinners? How does their situation compare, other things being equal, if they only had one, with only having one? They're earning more, and that's how it actually works out. And if that situation is generalized, the outcome is going to be that the real standard of living of the average working family goes up, even if it might mean that the average money wage per worker fell, because prices would fall to the same degree. Notice, the employment of more labor means more production. What does the fall in wage rates also mean about costs of production, unit costs of production? They go down, and wages are the fundamental cost. Wages, when you think of the impact of wages on costs, it's not just the wages at a given stage of production. Wages affect the cost of producing automobiles, not only by the wages of the auto workers, but also the wages of the steel workers, the wages of the iron miners, the wages of the tire workers, everything. If the average level of wages declines by half, that's going to operate pretty much to reduce the average unit cost of the products by half. And so, and whether you look at prices as governed by costs, which are halved, or as governed by demand and supply, with the supply being doubled, either way, prices are going to decline on the order of 50%. And if the family's income stays the same, their buying power is doubled. You had a question or comment?
You answered it.
I answered it. Okay, thank you. Yes, Mr. Alekis.
I don't think the price would fall by half. Not in a free capitalist society.
Yeah.
The price would probably remain the same, and owners would probably keep that money for themselves and end up probably maybe spending it elsewhere within the economy, which
Let's say they're spending it elsewhere within the economy.
Yeah.
Okay, so what is the output? In order for people to buy the output, the prices have to decline somewhere. Now, there's a very important principle that we don't cover in this course, but I deal with it in Chapter 6. It's known as the uniformity of profit principle. There's a tendency toward a uniform rate of return in all the different branches of the economic system. And whenever you have some branches of the economy earning very high rates of return relative to other branches, the consequence of that is that capital will move from the low profit lines into the high profit lines. That expands production in those lines. In order to find buyers for the additional goods, what has to happen to prices? They come down. When costs fall, unless it's a patented process or a secret technology, in fairly short order, prices are going to come down to correspond with the lower costs. Okay. And so if we had wage rates broadly falling, that would reduce costs and prices would decline commensurately. When you have improvements in the productivity of labor, prices also decline. Perhaps the most dramatic example in our own experience is the prices of a megabyte or a gigabyte of a hard drive space or of RAM. What's happened to these things over the last 20 years?
Prices
diminished tremendously. The prices of oil products are governed primarily by the price of crude oil. What happens to gasoline at the pump as crude oil goes up or down? It's following. So most prices are tied to costs. As costs go down, prices will go down. And even if they're not tied to costs, as employment goes up, production goes up, supply goes up, and more supply will drive prices down. Yes.
Also tied to, unless you have a monopoly with more production, you've got more people producing, so it now allows competition, and so therefore you're not necessarily just building more profit into your business model. You're looking at maybe the same levels or slightly higher, so the prices have to go down because your competitors that are now, because you've got all this labor pool, have the price they can produce, and so you can't be overpriced, so that's why I also.
Yeah, there would be more competition. That's exactly true. And look at it further, in terms of the relation between cost and price. You know, I gave you an example of what's happened to the unemployment rate and so on. Now, what has happened to the level of cost of production in real terms, in terms of how much labor it takes per unit of product over the last 200 years? We've already established, really, the amount of labor required per unit of product is on the order of 1% or even less. So this is a huge reduction in the level of real costs. Do you think the effect of this has been to show up simply as an enlargement of profits? What percentage of the price of products would now be profit if we had a 99% reduction in the basic costs, the basic unit costs, and if this served simply to enlarge profit? 99% of the price of everything would be profit. Do you think that the percentage of the price of things that is profit today is significantly different than the percentage of the price of things that was profit 100 or 200 years ago,
yes,
on an average?
No.
No, it isn't. The rate of profit has not undergone any major change up or down over this period of time. And what happens when costs are cut, the consequence is going to be, in fairly short order, prices will be cut. You can make a high profit by cutting costs so long as you alone have the ability to produce at the lower cost. If you're in the market first with the lower cost method, so long as you remain alone with it, you can make higher profits. But you're not going to remain alone for very long. Even if you have a patent, the patent is going to expire. And when it does, the price is going to come down. Yes.
Maybe a good example of that is people moving their productions overseas to get. Can you maybe talk about that?
Well, they try to move production overseas to take advantage of lower costs.
And smaller companies maybe can't do that yet.
Okay, but how does that show up too? To the extent that we now are producing television sets, microwave ovens, various other things outside the country at much lower costs, what's been the effect on the price of these things? They're much lower. You're getting television sets, I think, in some places for $70, a microwave oven for $40. The prices of some of these things are so low that it doesn't pay to repair them. Just junk them and get a new one. Like if you if something happens to your TV remote, no one will repair it. It's cheaper to get a new one produced outside the country. So the lower costs show up as lower prices. Now, if we're not dealing with married couples, let's suppose we have some immigrants. What do the immigrants need? What will be necessary to accommodate the immigrants in the labor force? Well, wage rates would have to fall. But what's the effect of the immigrants on production? There's more production, so we should expect prices to fall. Now, it's a little more complicated than that. It'll depend on what sort of immigrants. If the immigrants are all unskilled workers, then the wage rates of unskilled labor will decline relative to those of skilled and professional level labor. That'll go on for a point, but as the immigrants become assimilated, what happens to the children of the immigrants? Will they all have to be unskilled workers, or will many of them be moving higher up, and maybe many of the immigrants themselves after a while? Now, it's difficult to argue for totally free, unrestricted immigration the way things now stand, because we have a welfare state. When the immigrants cross the border, they're automatically entitled to all kinds of free public welfare benefits. They crowd the emergency rooms, supposedly their children are in the public schools, etc. And so that can represent a higher burden to the taxpayers. But suppose the taxpayers didn't have to meet those burdens. Suppose all of these things would be done privately. If you couldn't afford medical care, well, you have to work it out. The taxpayers are not going to provide it. So whatever the immigrants get, they have to earn. They have to earn. So they're not going to be any kind of public burden. Well, now, I would say that over a period of time, maybe it would take a generation for the effects to be fully felt. What is the effect of having people be able to live and work in a society and culture that is substantially freer and more rational than the one that they've come from in terms of their ability to develop and apply their talents?
Be able to produce more
earning. Again, they'll develop their talents to a higher degree, and to the extent that they're doing this at a high level, to the extent that we end up as the result of greater immigration, to the extent that within a generation or so we have more scientists, more inventors, more highly innovative, productive businessmen, what will be the effect of the immigration on the productivity of labor and standard of living in general as we allow a little time to go by? It'll be higher. Just think, suppose the United States had closed its doors to immigration in the middle of the 19th century. Again, would we have had Andrew Carnegie to develop the steel industry? Would we have had Sikorsky to develop the helicopter? All kinds of other people, either immigrants themselves or their children or grandchildren. See, free immigration into a free society means we're going to have a vastly more talent flourishing. And this operates to raise the general productivity of labor. It means more and better machinery, a higher output of goods relative to the supply of labor, a higher general standard of living. Unfortunately, with the kind of economy we have, there are these obstacles in the way, because many of the immigrants will just be a public burden, because we've decided that's the kind of system we're financing. Yes, Mr. Drew.
Could you say that with a larger employment pool, that people would be more likely to find a career that was best suited for their talents, rather than if you have a very small pool, people might be forced into careers to suit the need that maybe necessarily not what they were best at doing?
Well, the larger the participating population, the further the division of labor goes. There is a greater chance for people getting into something they like, I would assume. But what's very, very important is the larger the population you have cooperating in the system, the larger will be the absolute number of people working in fields that are acquiring and applying new knowledge. The larger the absolute number of scientists, engineers, inventors, businessmen. And this means a greater likelihood of new discoveries and new methods, better methods of production. Yes, the gentleman in the back, Mr. Doe.
I do agree that two things. One is that machinery does not take away jobs. That's one. And two, immigrants do not take away the jobs of individuals in America, because immigrants take the jobs that we do not want.
Well, that's very largely true.
Right.
That is largely true. But it could also be the case, it doesn't always have to be that way. Certainly, children of immigrants, or when they learn the language, they're capable of taking better jobs. But that doesn't mean they'd be taking jobs away. Even if they're doing the kinds of jobs we want to do, there'll be more such jobs.
The problem we have is technology advances.
Sorry?
The problem we have is technology and specialization. Specialization, everybody is working on one type of technology.
Yeah.
And therefore, when technology changes, it advances, there's not training. So I think individuals that are trained in technology create new jobs. That's why the unemployment is not by machinery, but the advanced technology.
Well, because of machinery, economic progress, a variety of things, people will have to change their jobs. They have to learn new skills. And this doesn't mean they first have to be out on the street. Most people are in a position to learn new skills while they still have their jobs. And I'm sure that's a factor for many of you. You're in a program like this, I would think, because you might have one eye on the possibility of losing your present job you want to have greater security for finding an alternative job or a better job. Yes, Ms. Bernard.
You brought up the emergency room, which I think is a good example. So how do we solve that solution? I mean, where we've got medical facilities, obviously there's a high demand, there's a high need for medical facilities that are closing down due to the demand is so high. Do you feel that the pay scale of the physicians to operate that is out of sync?
Well, this is a whole other major question. And I think I deal with this, if you look in the index, under medical or doctors, I have extensive discussion why we have the whole medical crisis, and I think I go into what could be done to alleviate it. And but that would take us into a discussion of the present insurance system. I don't want to go off on that track, because I do want to stay on the subject I have for tonight. Yes.
Would the service industries experience some of those same price reductions that you're talking about, with where price level, where there's like more workers, and you're talking about how prices would go down? Is that just for manufacturing companies?
No, everything. Certainly, to the extent that there are immigrants and they're working largely in the service industries, that's operating to make prices lower than they otherwise would be. The reason, you see, we have different factors going on at the same time. There are immigrants coming in. The birth rate itself is enlarging the population on the part of the people who are already here. So we have a growing labor force from year to year. Now, wage rates are rising in almost every year, even though we have a growing supply of labor. And what explains that? Yes?
They call it increased standard of living.
No, that is not what explains the rise in money wage rates.
Increased productivity.
The increased productivity is not what explains the rise in money wage rates. If we had the same number of workers producing twice as much, that's an increase in productivity. What's the effect of the same number of workers producing twice as much if there's no more money?
Prices go down.
So what is it that's making prices go up, even though we have more people working and they're working on average with a higher productivity?
A
growing quantity of money. The increase in the quantity of money and volume of spending is outstripping the increase in production and supply, and it's outstripping the increase in labor more than it outstrips the increase in the supply of goods. So wage rates tend to rise more rapidly than prices. If the you could work out examples on your own. Let me now go a little bit further. Here we are. The consumptionists think we have this problem. How do we move the demand curve? How do we move the demand curve? They think the demand curve is inadequate to the supply. Okay. Let's start looking at their methods of moving the demand curve. Well, one very favored method is nothing like a good war. Have you ever heard the argument or the claim that the war is a source of prosperity? Well, you must have, even if you hadn't heard it before this course, if you read Hazlitt, but you didn't have to read Hazlitt. If you just watched PBS, you'd hear it, and other sources. Well, how is war supposed to be a source of prosperity? What's it supposed to do in terms of this diagrammatic analysis? It will move the demand curve to the right. And that will reduce the extent to which there's a surplus of production, and it may even move the demand curve further to the right than the ability to produce. Now, how is it supposed to do that? Well, in a variety of ways. First, what happens when a country is getting involved in a war and is starting to make a major war effort? Okay, they will have to start producing things like tanks and planes and artillery shells and so forth. And it's thought, okay, well, now we need all of this war materiel. This is really good. It's going to take an awful lot of workers to produce all of these tanks, planes, etc. So that's going to be, that's going to move the demand curve too. See, we go into the war, and all we allegedly need and desire is the monk's habit, our loaf of bread, plus whatever the advertisers have managed to con us into desiring up to that point. But now, on top of all that, we'll need the tanks and planes and artillery shells and the rest. And so maybe now we might have full employment. And then there's a further beneficial effect of war from the perspective of the consumptionist, not from the perspective of anyone who's serious. And this is the destruction that it causes. How is war supposed to make an economic contribution by virtue of its destruction? They're rebuilding. Now there'll all be this wonderful work to do of rebuilding everything that's been destroyed. So not only do we have the precious work to do of building the tanks and cannons and whatever, we have the work to do of repairing everything that they've destroyed. This is really a terrific arrangement.
What money?
Pardon me?
With what money if their economy is down?
Well, they can also print the money. They'll print the money.
But,
pardon me?
And have to blow up the building
that
makes it.
Well, this is the idea. And then supposedly there's a further way that is not as significant but deserves some mention. Suppose we have a country such as the United States. It made a major war effort. We had a huge conversion of our economy to produce war material. We managed to escape the blessings of having any of our cities destroyed. The physical destruction on the territory of the United States in World War II, I think, was actually less, or on an order of magnitude, of the World Trade Center. There was the Japanese raid on Pearl Harbor, but that was pretty much the only destruction of actual American territory. Apart from that, they may have sent over one or two incendiary balloons that caused a fire in some forest in Washington, perhaps. But that was about all they could do in the way of damaging the territory of the United States. So we missed out on all of the good fortune of having to rebuild our cities. I hope you realize that this is said sarcastically. But there was another benefit that we did get in the war. In order to meet the demand for war material, the government prohibited the production of new private passenger automobiles. The 1942 model year ended the day after Pearl Harbor. There was no 43, 44, or 45 model year. There was no production of major appliances for civilian use. There was no new private civilian housing construction going on. All kinds of goods that people had taken for granted disappeared from the market. There were no ordinary chocolate bars, even. There were shortages of practically everything. You needed ration coupons to buy gasoline, tires, red meat. When you have shortages, you have people eager to buy things. There aren't enough available in the market to satisfy them. So you don't have to be too fastidious about what it is you're offering. So the quality of anything that's offered went way down. So that was the situation in World War II. Now, the consumptionists think, well, here we are. We've managed to get people to desire each year some number of automobiles, washing machines, whatever. And now we have a period of years they can't get any of these things. So they want to buy what they've been unable to get when the war ends. And the consumptionists say, well, this is a great pent-up demand. And so they think, well, that'll be good for a few years after the war. They think that's another way that war contributes to prosperity. Yes, Ms. Buckles.
What was the effect then, like, during a war when the men go off to the war? They're not employed here or at home anymore. So they're off the labor force.
That's perfectly true. And that would explain a major reduction in the unemployment rate all by itself.
But the government is employing them now.
They're employed in the armed services. Our defense establishment in World War II got up to 15 million There were 15 million soldiers and sailors. And so if you take that many people away who otherwise would have been in the labor market, it's no miracle that the unemployment problem evaporated. Now, of course, many people went to work who previously weren't working. A huge number of housewives entered the labor market to make up for the loss of young men. Many more high school students were working. So it wasn't a total net loss. It was made up to some substantial extent. Yes, Mr. Sadowski.
What happens to the market when all those soldiers come back?
Okay, that's a very good question. And I remember there were fears that when the war ended and the demobilization occurred, that we would return to large-scale unemployment. And I remember I was a child at that time, maybe about 7 years old or so. And I actually raised that question in a class because I had heard my parents talking about it. But it didn't materialize. The people who came back ended up pretty quickly being employed. Now, we'll see the reason 2 weeks from tonight. We'll see what enabled World War II to be accompanied by the end of the problem of mass unemployment. And then why also we didn't revert to mass unemployment right after World War II. But it was only when the war ended that we achieved real prosperity. Then the economy went back to producing civilian goods. Now, the actual effect of war, we don't need a war to have full employment. If we have economic freedom, we can have full employment without any stimulation of any kind. Essentially, what do we need to have the quantity of labor demanded made equal to the supply of labor available?
We need more demand.
Well, you say we need more demand. What will increase the quantity demanded without taking any artificial steps to boost the demand? If wage rates are free to fall, Now, you could also think, well, why don't we just increase the money supply and solve the problem that way? And there are conceivable contexts in which that might work. But what if you didn't want to have a monetary system that the government is free to increase as much as it likes? Suppose, you see, let me give you a kind of analogy. Let's suppose we have a severe crime problem. Now, one possible way of solving the crime problem would be very substantially to increase the powers of the police to arrest suspects. And that might do the job. But would that be a desirable way to accomplish the result? Would we want the police having arbitrary power to arrest people?
No.
Or would we seek a better way, let them do better detective work, let them do better surveillance, whatever? We don't want the government to have the power of arbitrary arrest, certainly, even if in certain contexts it might reduce the crime rate. Now, even if in certain contexts increasing the quantity of money and volume of spending might reduce unemployment, I don't think it's something that it's desirable, a power that it's desirable for the government to have. We don't want the government able to determine the value of everybody's life savings just because it's increasing the quantity of money. We don't want the quantity of money and its buying power to be a political football. Well, there is traditionally a way to avoid that. And what way is that? What way was that? That was the gold standard. So if we were going to maintain the gold standard, an arbitrary increase in the quantity of money is not an option. That's not an option. We have to adjust wage rates to the quantity of money as given by the gold standard and the state of gold production. Now, what happens was, when we had the gold standard, people would always be screwing with it in one form or another, But they could only do so temporarily, up to a limited point. They could expand the quantity of money beyond what corresponded to the supply of gold, but they could only do that up to a point. At some point, if you're going to maintain the connection to gold, you've got to stop expanding the quantity of money beyond the connection, beyond the supply of gold. Well, in the periods in which they were expanding it more rapidly than gold, they'd have a boom. Spending would be picking up sharply, business conditions would look good, the stock market might be rising. And the economy got used to this expansion in money and spending and came to a certain degree to depend on its continuation. But then when you stop it because you're at the limit of the quantity of money that's compatible with the gold standard, the foundation of the boom was cut away. The stock market would tank, the demand for money for holding would rise, velocity would fall, you'd have a decline in spending. If the decline in spending is significant, well, to whatever extent it's occurring, business sales revenues fall. What's that do to business profits? They drop. What's it do to cash flow and the ability to repay debt? Those things shrink. So some businesses can fail. And if they owe substantial sums to banks, what happens to the banks? They can fail. And what does that do to the quantity of money? I mean, that falls. So there was a basis for financial contractions. They wouldn't have occurred if we didn't have the expansion of fiduciary media. Had you had 100% reserve, you wouldn't have had that problem. But we didn't have 100% reserve. So we had periodic booms and busts. But when there's a bust, the economy can adjust to it, can get out of the depression, get back to full employment and full production. But what's required if you have a reduction in money and spending? You need wage rates and prices free to fall. Now, in all of our previous depressions prior to 1929, wage rates and prices did fall quite sharply within a fairly short period of time, and we got back to full employment and full production. In 1929, there was a profound difference, and that was that President Hoover was in the White House, and Hoover believed, along with many, many other people, many businessmen and writers, that it was wrong to cut wage rates in the face of unemployment. And they accepted the erroneous idea that if you cut wage rates, that served to reduce consumer demand and make the depression worse. Now, it's true that if you cut the wage rate of any given worker, that worker will make a smaller demand. If he earns less, he spends less. But it's fallacious to assume that all workers taken together will be spending less if there will be more workers employed as the result of the fall in wage rates. If we have the average worker earning a certain wage, and now his wage falls to some extent, but there are that many more workers working at the lower wage, sufficiently more workers working, their consumer spending need not be any lower. It may even be greater. Well, Hoover called White House conferences of the major businessmen of the country and got them to agree not to take advantage of the unemployment to reduce wage rates, not to reduce wage rates in advance of reductions in prices. And the result was that the fall in wage rates in the 29 Depression proceeded far, far more slowly than in any previous depression. I think in 1930, when there was already mass unemployment, wage rates fell an average of 3%. Even in 31, they may have fallen 6 or 7%. Back in 1921, within 1 year, the fall in wage rates was much bigger than it took several years in the Depression of 29. And the Depression of 21 was over very, very quickly. Now, when you interfere with the fall in wage rates, that leads to further financial contraction when people are expecting that wage rates will fall. Because put yourself in the position of a firm contemplating some form of investment. Here you are, you're looking at the present level of construction costs, and there's an awful lot of unemployed construction workers. There are unemployed workers producing construction materials. What will be your expectation as to the cost of construction in 6 months, a year or so? They think they'd be substantially lower. So when will you commit to make to your construction project? Now? It'll all be postponed. Now, this postponement of investment spending, which took place on a massive scale in 30, 31, 32, to such a degree that net investment was actually a negative number in those years. When firms radically curtail their investment spending and are holding funds waiting to make their expenditures later on, when they expect costs will be lower, well, what's the effect on the volume of spending now? There's less spending than there otherwise would have been. Lower sales, revenues, profits, cash flow, more business failures, more bank failures, a further contraction. The depression went further, the contraction was greater, precisely because of the failure of money wage rates to fall, prohibiting their fall. We could have gotten out of the depression by 1931, most likely, had the government not interfered with wage rates. But instead, the interference grew worse with the New Deal. In 1932, shortly before the New Deal took power, the Congress was already controlled by the Democratic Party. The Norris-LaGuardia Act was enacted. That prohibited employers from getting a federal injunction against labor union intimidation. So that gave a lot of new power to unions. In 1933, the National Recovery Act was passed. That embodied much of today's labor law. The NRA was found unconstitutional, but its provisions with respect to labor were quickly reenacted under the Wagner Act. And this is what made it very easy for labor unions to organize and extend their influence beyond construction and the railroads, which was what they were more or less limited to in the 1920s. They could then organize the steel industry, automobiles, cement, metalworking, etc. And what do you think happened to wage rates in the midst of mass unemployment in 1933 and thereafter? They started actually rising in the midst of mass unemployment. Now, practically the day after it took office, or within weeks, the New Deal abolished the gold standard, gave itself the ability to start expanding the quantity of money once again. And the quantity of money did expand from 1933 on, has continued to expand to the present day. But when you have the labor unions greatly empowered and they're out there actually raising wage rates in the midst of mass unemployment, the additional spending will not have all that much effect. In fact, if the labor unions are really able to go at it, you can have a situation where spending rises at huge rates, but if wage rates are rising just as fast, are you making headway against unemployment? You don't make headway. And we've had Latin American countries where spending and prices may double every year, wage rates are doubling, and they've had mass unemployment alongside of massive increases in money and spending. And we could easily have had that going on after the 30s. What happened in World War II was we had more massive creation of money to finance the war, but the ability of the unions to raise wage rates was essentially ended. Does anyone know what ended it? What major wartime measure prohibited the unions from raising wage rates to any degree beyond what the government was willing to permit?
World War II.
What about World War II? What special accompaniment of the war? Well, we had all-round wage and price control. The government made it illegal for employers to raise their prices without permission of a special government board, the Office of Price Administration, and it made it illegal for unions to raise wage rates. It imposed ceiling prices on everything. Now, this doesn't mean there were zero price increases, but they were very, very limited, and they were far below what corresponded to the increase in the quantity of money and the ability to spend money. Now, this explains how it came to be, that World War II was a period of full employment. It was not anything physically connected with the war. It was not the need for war materiel. It was not the physical destruction of the war. It was not pent-up demand or anything of that kind. Here we have price and wage. I put them both on the vertical axis, prices and wages. Here's a demand curve. Let's say that this represents the supply of labor. We'll just do wage rates. Here's wage rates, here's the supply of labor. And there had been this downshift in demand back in the 20s, up to 1929, the demand for labor had been here. We had full employment. But now we have a financial contraction. The demand for everything, labor and goods, declines. There's a reduction in the quantity of money. The velocity of money is lower. So we have a demand here. But now President Hoover is keeping wage rates up at this level. Here's I'll call it H, wages Hoover. If wage rates are remaining at the pre-depression level, but now we have a decline in demand, what should you expect to happen?
The quantity of labor.
The quantity of labor demand is going to be down here. The supply available is up here. What is this?
Unemployment.
That's the unemployment. Now, is there a way to get out of this, even with this reduced demand curve?
Not with the wage rates fall.
Wage rates would have to fall down to here. We'd have full employment with this lower demand curve without any war. Now, we didn't have that because first Hoover is preventing it, and then the New Deal came in, and the unions are actually raising wage rates. Well, what we have in World War II, as I've indicated, we had a massive increase in the quantity of money and volume of spending, and wage rates continued to be frozen out here. I'm doing this a little too steeply. If wage rates are more or less frozen at this pre-war level, what will be the quantity of labor demanded on this higher demand curve? It'll be out to here, right?
Yes.
All right, now what is this distance? What does this represent?
Shortage.
A labor shortage. It's the excess of the quantity of labor demanded over the supply available. And this occurred as the result of a combination of massive increases in the money supply to pay for the war, which increased people's capacity to spend, and at the same time, wage rates were essentially frozen. So that's how we had full employment. We could have had full employment without the war. And if we had been able not to have the war, then we would not have needed to produce all the tanks, planes, artillery shells, whatever. We'd have full employment with people producing automobiles, houses, appliances, luxury goods, having a higher standard of living. Now, I don't want to suggest that we should not have been in the war, but I do want to suggest that we never derive prosperity from a war. It can be necessary to fight a war to preserve the freedom of the country, but we don't prosper from that. We do it at enormous cost. Like, it may be necessary for you to own a gun, and if you're accosted, to pull the gun. But presumably you're not going to enjoy that thing. That's not going to be a source of your enjoyment. It's something that's imposed upon you by circumstances beyond your control. You have to do it. You'd rather not be in that situation. But you don't want to live your life that way. Or you certainly don't prosper that way. And in World War II, the standard of living of the average person was far below what it had been in the worst years of the Depression. In the worst years of the Depression, 3 out of 4 people were working. The unemployment rate never got above 25%. That was high enough. But the 3 out of 4 who were working were able to buy anything that was commensurate with their earnings. The goods produced were of all very high quality. In World War II, as I've said, whole categories of goods ceased to be produced. The government ordered the automobile plants, stop producing automobiles, you're now going to produce tanks and jeeps, and throughout the whole of the economy. And I've described the situation. So people were working, they were working long and hard, but they were getting much, much less for the work they did. They're getting much less in terms of goods and services. And we can see this in terms of an example with the class. Imagine the people sitting in the interior of the class, they're all unemployed. And we're going to get into a war. I'll be the government. They'll be producing tanks and planes for me. But now that they're working, they're going to need to be supplied by you guys. They have to be better off working than they were before. And you guys will be producing many of the materials they use and the equipment. So their output is coming to me and then going on to the battlefield. Your output, or a good part of your output, is going to them. What output is coming back to remunerate you? You're not getting any output. You're working and producing. The unemployed, their output is going to the government for the war effort or whatever. A part of the output of the previously employed, the already employed, that's going to the re-employed people, but nothing is coming back to compensate them. It's a kind of broken circle. And this very same point applies to non-war government activity. If we're not fortunate enough to get into a good war, then the consumptionists have other tricks up their sleeve, and the most prominent one being just expand government spending. Just have the government get involved in all kinds of new projects, build new roads, whether they go anywhere, that's not so important, build dams, whatever, courthouses, all kinds of public works projects for the sake of creating employment. Well, again, the output of the unemployed is going to the government. The output of the already employed, part of it is going to remunerate the newly employed. What's feeding back to compensate those who already had jobs? Nothing of comparable significance. Yes, Mr. Gaines.
Isn't it true, though, that an increase in government spending helps reduce the effects of recessions?
Well, you see, that's the idea, that an increase in government spending reduces the recessions. If it can do so to the extent that wage rates do not rise to the same degree, and if you have a labor union movement that has lost much of its power, which is pretty much the situation today, although it might be changing, if the unions do not take advantage of the increase in money and spending to raise wages, or if for whatever reason they're unable to, then the expansion in money and spending can result in additional people being employed. It's just you're increasing money and the spending it supports, and you're increasing money and spending relative to wages. Would there be another way to accomplish the same result without the government increasing the quantity of money?
And reduce taxes?
Well, if they reduce taxes and maintain their spending, how do they perform that?
Borrow.
And if they borrow, they can't keep borrowing indefinitely, or the debt keeps building up. What do they have to do to be able to borrow continually without having to worry about facing bankruptcy?
Make more money.
They have to create money. Now, I mentioned a little while back, I said there are situations where maybe giving the police extraordinary powers could serve to reduce the crime rate. But that's not something we would want to do, even if it were successful. In the same way, there are circumstances, and maybe today is one of them, where the government's power to increase the quantity of money can serve to reduce unemployment and stave off a depression. But this requires that the government have the power to increase the quantity of money as much as it likes. What problems does that create? Well, we have chronic inflation. What does it do to the security of any kind of pension or long-term contract?
Devalues.
It takes it away. And how does it affect the way people perceive their relation to the government? Just think for a moment. If the government did not have the power to create money, if the money were gold, the government can't create gold. Where must it get the money that it wants to spend?
The people.
From the citizens. The government has to go to the citizens and say, I need money. It would get it by taxes. Are the citizens happy to pay the taxes? No. Now, what would be the effect of this arrangement where whatever money the government spent, it had to get from the citizens? What would be the effect on the popularity of spending proposals?
Not good.
You see, if the government doesn't have the option of creating money, and which would mean it also can't borrow money for very long, if you borrow money without the ability to create money, you're headed for bankruptcy. Mm-hmm. You have to be utterly reckless and irresponsible to do that. I don't think our government is that reckless. Maybe California's government is, but I don't think the federal government is. So borrowing is out as an option if they can't create money, which means the only way to finance additional spending is to raise taxes or to cut other spending. Well, now imagine in that environment, someone has a new spending proposal. He's calculated how many working mothers would be benefited by publicly financed daycare centers. And he can show you how many of them would be helped by this. But suppose at the same time, we have to raise people's taxes to pay for it. Well, how do you think that would affect the equation?
A lot of people would
say, well, I sympathize with the working mothers, but I just can't afford to pay to solve their problem. So they'll have to work it out a different way. Now think how differently this appears if the government has its own money and can finance that or any other project without having to raise taxes, because it has the ability to print the funds if it wishes. Well, in that light, does it appear that there is a necessary, closely connected cost for this project?
No.
No, it doesn't. And that's why we get the present status of political debate. We have two sides. There's one side, the friends of humanity and all that's good. And what they do is they enumerate the benefits of a proposal. They say, well, look at these poor working mothers. Don't you sympathize with them? Now their children will be taken care of. They can work. And this is all very nice and fine. And what decent human being could be against this? Well, if there were no cost, no decent human being could be against it. And if there is no perceptible, closely connected cost, what is the likelihood of that and many, many other measures being enacted? They then will get through, and the opponents are made to appear as nasty old curmudgeons. They're just against what's good for the people. And this is how political debate routinely goes on. The liberals, they're compassionate and they love everybody and they just want everybody to be better off. And there's those nasty old meanies, the conservatives, they just want people to suffer. Well, they're looking at the cost, but most people are unable to see the cost because the government doesn't have to raise taxes. They can just create new and additional money. So what do you think this has done to the size of the government? It's greatly expanded. One of the major effects of this change in the monetary system has been a radical expansion in the size of the government in the conviction, the mistaken belief, that the government can provide free benefits. And it's totally reversed the way people see themselves in relation to the government. If the government had to collect money from the citizens would then realize that the government is dependent on them. The government would be financially dependent on the people. But when the government has the power to create money, the people think they are financially dependent on the government, because the government is now the source of their money. But you see, you're reversing the relationship between the citizen and the state. Instead of the citizen being primary, instead of the citizen having the last word, and the government being the servant beholden to the citizen feels that he's the servant beholden to the government. This is a total reversal of the original system of government that we had. And if there were no other reason, this would be sufficient, I think, on behalf of the gold standard, and to maintain that standard, when there's a recession, get out of it, not by the creation of more money, even if that would do it, but get out of it by the reduction in wage rates and prices. That would be consistent with a system of small government, a system where people could count on the future buying power of money, not fear that when they get old and retire, whatever sums they have, if they live long enough, will be worth only a fraction of what they were when they started. Yes?
I do think today, though, I mean, I see more of versus a reduction in wage rates, more of a control that with wage bands, to where your wages as a worker are not going up proportionately with the cost of living. And companies, rather than saying, okay, if I'm paying you $10 an hour, you're going to go down to $8 an hour, they're just saying you're not going to get a 3% increase every year. At some point, the job will only pay X amount.
Yeah, real wages can fall to the extent that the rise in prices surpasses the rise in real wages, in money wages.
Cutting.
Yeah.
It's just cutting it instead of increasing it.
Yeah, but what is responsible in large part for that is the tremendous expansion in government and the extent to which it undercuts the people's ability to save as a result. And also, closely related, the idea that regulation is costless. And one of the reasons for wages not keeping pace is we enact more and more regulations that impose costs, and there has to be something else that the cost of which will not go up so much. That's labor. Okay, so we could have full employment, full production. We don't need government boondoggles. We could have it with a modest, small government. Let's go further in the analysis of the implications of consumptionism. I refer to the belief that population growth is the source of prosperity. And how is that supposed to be the case? Well, population growth will create more consumers who each have their own consumer desires. In the years after World War II, when we had the baby boom, consumptionists were very excited. They were looking forward to the surge in children reaching marriageable age, and then they'll need houses, furniture, automobiles, everything to go with it. And that's enough new additional consumer desire, they thought, to keep all of the factories and the rest of the economic system humming, producing for them. So the idea is all we need is more people, and they'll make an economic contribution by virtue of desiring things. You see, we allegedly have a shortage of needs and desires. Our needs and desires are not up to our ability to produce, but with more people, maybe we have a shot. Well, something is overlooked. What's the effect to the extent these new people, when they reach adulthood, have to find jobs? How must the consumptionists view them then?
It's growth in demand.
When they're looking for jobs, keep in mind the consumptionist view of things.
They are fixed among them.
There's allegedly a fixed amount of work to be done. Keep in mind, here's the situation. Here's our starting point. We're able to produce more than we need and desire. But now, if we have more people, first we have little children. They need baby food, toys, and bicycles. So that allegedly means some increase in consumer demand. We move it from here to here. And then when they get married and need houses, automobiles, and all the rest of it, well, that will move the demand much further over. So in what capacity does the additional population allegedly make an economic contribution? In its capacity as consumers. Now, if they go to work, and we look down here, if this was our full employment point originally, and we're working with better machinery, we have this unemployment, and we have this surplus overproduction, unemployment. How will the extra people help if, besides consuming more, they want to work more? If here they are, they're going to work on this more efficient production function, what will be the effect on output? They'll increase the output, and will we have solved the problem? They'll have provided desires equal to the old output, But now these foolish people, by insisting on working, what have they done to the output? They've increased it further. So have we caught up? Have we solved the problem?
No.
What would it take to solve the problem from the perspective of the consumptionists?
If they don't work.
Yeah, if these additional people will be gracious enough to have houses, furniture, whatever, but not work. The ideal is that they be bums, and that's how they will make their economic contribution. See, the idea of the consumptionists is that the producers are producing more than they, the producers, need or desire. That's the surplus of S over D. The producers only need and desire DD, but they're producing SS, bigger. So the problem is an inadequacy of desire. And now they allegedly require another set of people who will be gracious enough to consume without producing. So their consumption without production will allegedly balance these guys' production without consumption. It's the argument that the producers have this absurd desire to produce without consuming. And they need a class of parasites who'll be gracious enough to consume without producing. Then they'll be happy. They can continue working and producing beyond what they want, and the others will keep them busy by consuming. Yes, Mr. Doe.
Can you comment on the Hazen, what he's talking about, the drive for export, how it relates to this? Still trying to increase the population.
Well, I think that'll come up in the very next point we discuss.
I think I got a good example about the policy you mentioned, because a lot of my friends are international students and they are not allowed to work. So they're basically, they are just consuming all the time. They are not producing at all.
Yeah, I mean, foreign students here in the United States, you need special government permission if you're a foreigner. You need special permission to be able to work. You have to get a precious green card. Now, why do they make it that hard to work? Well, it's the idea there's a scarce, precious stock of work to be done, and we have to guard it. It's the same issue, the same mentality as the union's make work scheme. They want to stop people from working. They fear people's working. And here, it's an even bigger issue. The consumptionists believe the extra people would be valuable as consumers and harmful as producers. Now, the reality is the only way in which the extra people are economically valuable is as producers. We don't need non-producing consumers. No one is gaining from people consuming at his expense.
So are saying that our government has been consumptionist?
Yeah, our government is consumptionist. The labor unions are consumptionist. Major economic authors are consumptionist, like Lord Keynes, all of the textbooks that follow his analysis. It's a very widespread phenomenon. Whoever thinks machinery causes unemployment, whoever thinks women take jobs from men, whoever thinks that immigrants are taking jobs from natives, all of these are consumptionists. Whoever thinks it's necessary to make work, that's a consumptionist. Whoever thinks that there's this benefit we're talking about from extra people operating merely as consumers and that we're threatened if they go to work, that's consumptionism.
Okay.
And there are yet further ways, and we'll look at them. I refer to the related support for a policy of imperialism. And this had its main application back in the days of World War I, or so it was thought. According to many leftist authors, such as Lenin and other of his followers, all of the advanced capitalist countries in Europe had a problem of overproduction. So here's France, here's Germany, here's Great Britain. They all allegedly have a problem of overproduction. And what do they need to solve it? They need consumers. They need consumer desires. And where can they find them? Well, population growth at home, maybe that's one possibility. But there's something very similar and much, much bigger to be found abroad. And that is the vast populations of impoverished, backward countries. Above all, China and India. Now, how does the consumptionist perceive such countries? Well, he looks, first of all, at the magnitude of their populations, and then he thinks of all of the goods that they don't have but which people in the advanced countries have been conned into wanting to have. To apply this in present terms, a consumptionist would think, all right, here we are in the United States. We've succeeded in getting people to buy so many automobiles per 1,000 people. I don't know what the number is. I'm sure it's several hundred per 1,000 people. And we have however many television sets per 1,000 and cell phones and on, good by good. And now the consumptionist looks at China and India, other heavily populated, very poor countries, and what's he thinking? He's thinking, well, how many automobiles do they have per 1,000 people? Let's imagine in the U.S. we have 600 automobiles per 1,000 people, and in India they have 5 automobiles per 1,000 people. Now the consumptionists will be thinking, boy, oh boy, that means we have a potential of getting them to take 595 more automobiles per 1,000 people over in India. And then think of how many millions of thousands of people they have. Or maybe it's 1,000,000 people, 1,000,000 units of 1,000 people, each of whom, that'll give them a population of 1,000,000,000. And each of these 1,000 is a potential outlet for 595 automobiles. We'll multiply 595 times 1,000,000, and here we are, India becomes a potential market for 595 million automobiles. And now apply the same thing with television sets, microwave ovens, one thing after another. And the way the consumptionists view these heavily populated, very, very poor countries is they're an immense potential market. This is just great. If we get our hands on this, that'll solve our problem of overproduction for generations. We'll be busy night and day serving their markets. We've got additional markets. Well, allegedly, this idea occurred not just to one country. It occurred to France, Germany, England, all at the same time. And it was such a great prize to get these markets that they ended up going to war over them. Now, just think, what would you have had you gotten it? The way a consumptionist views markets is, he thinks it's a set of consumer needs and desires, and if the people need something, you'll provide it to them, and you'll have the work to do of producing it. Are people a market merely because they have needs? Which country is a bigger market in the world, India or Japan?
Japan
is a much bigger market. Which country has a greater set of needs, more urgent needs?
India,
by far. India has 1,000,000,000 people. Japan has not too much more than 100,000,000. The standard of living in Japan is not much lower than our own. The standard of living in India is a small fraction of ours. India has immense needs, but does that give them the ability to buy? Does a beggar who has a desperate need for a good meal, does that give him the ability to buy the meal?
No,
need is not the source of demand. It's not the basis of demand. That's one of the points Hazlitt makes very well, that need is not demand. We should not confuse the two. Nor is mere creation of money demand. It's not even just money. India's problem is not that they lack rupees. The Indian government could easily manufacture billions of new and additional rupees. That's their monetary unit. Would that enable them to buy more in the world market? What would happen if they manufactured the rupees?
They would devalue the value of the rupee.
The value of the rupee would plunge, and the additional rupees might end up, the larger supply of rupees might end up actually buying less than the original supply. The plunge could be greater than the increase in the quantity. Well, what does a country need to be able to buy? What does an individual need to be able to buy? Well, it's not just money, because money can be manufactured. They need to be able to produce goods and services which you can sell and get the money that way. Those countries are markets to the extent that they are producers. Japan is a major market because Japan is a major producer. Each country is a market to the extent that it's a producer. Its production gives it the wherewithal to make purchases. Individuals are buyers, they're consumers, to the extent that they're producers and have earned the money by virtue of production. Now, the consumptionists do not want these countries to be producers. See, they think that they're valuable simply as taking our goods. They think they're valuable as a source of our exports, as receiving our exports. How does the consumptionist react to the prospect of their us importing from them? How's he reacting right now to the imports from Japan and China? He doesn't like it. He fears the imports. He doesn't want the imports. What would it be? What's his view of the ideal arrangement that would really be a benefit to us? That we export to the maximum possible extent while importing to the minimum possible extent. And this shows up in the terminology of a favorable balance of trade. This is what the press thinks is favorable, that we should export greater than we import, ideally only export and not import. Well, that is not an advantageous way to conduct trade. The value of foreign trade is, in fact, in the imports. That's how we get rewarded for our foreign trade. Yes, Mr. Rocaney.
So, how does the consumptionist think that people get the money to buy their goods if they don't want them to produce anything?
How does he think they get the money to buy their goods? Now, the consumptionist, a variation, one answer, and I think this will relate to the question someone raised about the drive for exports, was Mr. Doe. One way that the consumptionist thinks they'll get money is we'll give it to them. And we'll have exports that we finance. So their idea is if they're not earning the money, well, we'll give them the money, and then we'll have the pleasure of being able to sell them the goods. Now, this has been compared to a restaurant, let's say, that employs a doorman to give passersby $50 bills, but only on condition that they spend the money in that restaurant. Now, do you think that would be a reasonable way of doing business? No. Well, but there are many people who you think would be reasonably intelligent. They think that we benefit economically from the foreign aid that we give. Why do we benefit? Because the recipients of the aid will spend the money we give them in our economy. Now, there may be some businesses that benefit, but the people who pay for it are losing. And we might as well just take the money from the American taxpayer, transfer it to the business that's going to sell the goods, then they'd have the benefit, they could skip the sale. This is an imbecilic policy, yet it's advocated. And this same doctrine, the alleged benefit from having these alleged foreign markets surfaced in the Vietnam War. The left often argued that the United States was in Vietnam to secure a toehold in the vast markets of Southeast Asia. Now, the way they saw markets, as I've explained, is that means you give your goods away for free, which would have been a pretty stupid arrangement from our point of view. But it appears the people of Vietnam who are going to get free goods, they're too smart to go for a deal like that. So we have to send in the army so we'll then have the benefit of being able to give our goods away for free. And World War I was fought for the privilege of giving goods away for free. That's the consumptionist argument. Now, maybe Imperial Germany was in World War I for such an idiot reason, but I don't think Britain was. Now, let me jump ahead to this to advertising. I refer to the belief that advertising is inherently fraudulent yet economically necessary. From what perspective, in the consumptionist view of things, would advertising be inherently fraudulent by its very nature?
Pardon me? Advertising says you need
Yeah, we really don't need any of this stuff. We really just need a loaf of bread and a monk's habit and a stool and a straw mat. And that's our needs. And the advertisers have conned us into wanting this whole array of things that we don't need. So it's inherently fraudulent on the foundation of the idea that our true, genuine, legitimate needs are next to nothing. And the advertisers are catering to needs and desires beyond those of a monk. So that's why they're viewed as inherently fraudulent. What is the perspective from which advertising is viewed at the same time as economically necessary? Yes, Mr. Gates?
Well, it informs the public of the products without them having to go out and do the research.
I'm asking from the perspective of the consumptionist. Yes?
To close the gap between full employment and to decrease unemployment.
Yeah, to the extent that the advertisers are successful, it will move the demand curve. If they can con the people enough, well, maybe they'd make the demand equal to the supply, and they'd eliminate the problem of unemployment and overproduction. So that's how the consumptionists think advertising makes a contribution. Precisely in getting people to have desires for things they don't need, it serves to enable other people to be employed in producing these things. Yes, Mr. Doe? I don't hear you.
You can decrease the supply if you do better market. Because the thing is that you're producing more than you the demand, therefore you do that on the level that you need to produce.
Yes, but you see, the consumptionist sees that as precisely the problem, because suppose we produce only this much, then how many people can be employed if this is the production function? If people will only take this much, how much labor do we need to produce that much?
But instead of wasting the labor to produce that product.
Pardon me?
Product.
Well, we're talking about the whole economy here, not just an isolated product. So cutting the production is not a solution, because then you just have the unemployment.
Well, not cutting the production, it's producing more of what people want.
Yeah, but the consumptionist says they don't want anything. They really don't want anything. Now, that's nonsense, of course. There's no limit to what people want, and so we really don't have this kind of problem. But I'm just trying to develop what the consumptionists believe is a problem. And they think that advertising, while inherently fraudulent, is economically necessary. They have this contradictory moral view with respect to advertising and also with respect to war. From a moral point of view, they have to condemn war, but from an economic point of view, they think it's really good. And from a moral point of view, they condemn advertising, but from an economic point of view, they think it's really good. Now, in the days before the environmentalists, the consumptionists might very well have a positive view of science and technology and think that in our present society, science and technology perversely work as evils. But today, of course, they're perhaps more consistent. They would largely be environmentalists who think that science and technology are evils to begin with, and therefore it's not surprising that they're causing unemployment, at least according to consumptionism. Now, it follows from this next point, a belief in the purposelessness and irrationality of economic life. What do I mean by that? Well, let's suppose that the advertisers have done such a good job that people are willing to buy everything that can be produced, and we have full employment. Now, from the perspective of the consumptionist, what have we got when we've got it? Let's say the advertisers have gotten people to want the equivalent of all that we're able to produce. So we're going along at full employment and we're producing all this stuff.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, what have we got when we've got it from the perspective of the consumptionist?
Zero demand.
Meaningless stuff.
It's all meaningless.
Yeah.
We have a society where everyone is very busy devoting his life to the production of things nobody needs. That's how the consumptionist views things. They think we don't. Their view is that the far greater part of our production is essentially junk. That's how they think of it. And yet, for prosperity, we need to keep people very busy producing all of this stuff. And I think views of this kind serve to promote environmentalism. How could someone advocate measures that would reduce production hugely? Like a UN panel called for, not all that long ago, a 60% reduction in carbon dioxide emissions. And if you think of all of the things that emit carbon dioxide, I think our cars emit it, the power plants emit it, our appliances are part of it. What would happen to our level of production if we had to curtail carbon dioxide emissions 60%? It would decrease incredibly, maybe even more than 60%. Well, how can anyone advocate such a thing? Well, if you think that 60% of our production is useless junk, then it's not such a big deal. And I think that's how many, many environmentalists view it. They're largely consumptionists. They don't appreciate the value of the economic system. They don't appreciate the products. But if we value the products, we don't view advertising as fraudulent. There are certainly some fraudulent advertisers, but that is not the basic nature of the activity. The reason we have advertising is the producer and the consumer in a division of labor society are separate people, and the consumers don't automatically know what's available on what terms or where. And the basic function of advertising is to provide that kind of information. And what advertising does, advertising does not increase overall demand. Advertising serves to switch the direction of demand. People become aware of some products more than they otherwise would have. They decide to buy those. But what would they have done with their money otherwise? Would they have just stuffed it under their mattress? They'd have bought some other things. So it's a diversion of demand. Advertising may contribute to production to the extent that people become aware of things that they so much want to have that they're willing to go out and do extra work to earn the money to buy the things. To that extent, advertising would serve to increase overall production. For the rest, it's enabling people to consume in a better way, a more knowledgeable way than they otherwise would have. Okay, let me ask if there are any questions, comments. I haven't dealt with each and every point I had on the list, but I think I have covered the most important ones. So let me hear any comments, reactions in the last few minutes. Yes, Ms. Buckles?
So in a sense, are you saying that consumptionists are like the left, people on the left, and the productionists are people on the right?
I would say to a large degree that's true. I wouldn't say perfectly. I'm sure you'd find exceptions. But I would say, you see, the way if you're a consumptionist, you're viewing the economic system as paradoxical, deriving benefit from moral evils, war and advertising. And most consumptionists, prior to the advent of environmentalism, I think there was a huge overlap between consumptionism and socialism. Socialists were leading advocates of consumptionism, like Lenin. And their view would be, it's under capitalism that you have these perverse outcomes. Under capitalism, war is economically advantageous, fraud is advantageous, science and technology cause unemployment. But under socialism, science and technology will work for the good of mankind. No one will gain from war or fraud. So they thought it's an indictment of capitalism, and they would be socialists. Today, I think they would largely be environmentalists. Yes?
Does the gold standard always have a cycle of boom and bust?
Does the gold standard always have a cycle of boom and bust? No, it depends on what kind. See, a 100% reserve gold standard would not. 100% reserve gold standard would not allow the creation of money to feed the boom, nor create the potential for the destruction of that money in the bust.
Okay. didn't we have that?
No, we never had 100% reserve gold standard. We always had a fractional reserve gold standard. The banks could expand the quantity of money up to a point, but then they'd reach a limit. They'd have to stop the process, and when that occurred, things would go into reverse. All right, anything else? All right, I hope you found this discussion of interest. I think it deals with a lot of important matters, and hopefully it gives you the framework to understand some of these things. At least I hope so. So I'll see you all next week. Have a good one. Thank you.